Well, this morning's lesson, last week I didn't record it. I didn't. Did one of those kind of things. So nervous about everything. So I never wanted to be a minister. I never could handle the pressure. But anyway, so we're in the Abrahamic covenant, and I have a lesson prepared for you. It looks like this. Okay, I won't read that to you. When you get done, you'll have an education. But I'm also concerned that, and I asked some ladies back here, because they're in a lot of my classes, if anybody's up to speed with the stuff, they would be. How familiar are you with the whole issue of Israel becoming a state? I mean, just the ball flower, that's a word that comes up all the time.
Never heard of it.
See, and I think probably what I'm going to do today, I'm going to scrap my plan that I was going to do. We're just going to put it off, and it'll probably, I don't want to scare anybody, but it'll probably take 3 weeks to work through it, because I have 100, and these are half pages, 114 half pages of text. And I don't want to just zip through it and read through it, but I want to explain stuff to you. And I thought, well, maybe what I need to do before I do this is go through it verbally and let you ask questions so that we have somewhat of a footing for us to understand what we're talking about. Now, I've studied this for years. It's not a new subject. So when I look at it, yeah. But if somebody hasn't read much on it or nothing on it, it becomes very difficult to understand what's happening. So I was going to do this as my introduction. I'm going to still do it as an introduction because our study of the Abrahamic covenant, we're to the point of the land portion. By the way, my little mountain there is to show support. We first of all have God said, and let there be light, and there was the earth, and you know, so forth. The 6 days of creation occurred with his word. It's the same word that he says, the same mouth that said, I will give you this land, Abraham. The same God says it with the same authority, with the same power. And I'll give you this land, seed, and blessing, which is the part of the Abrahamic covenant we're going to talk about. We're going to start with the land covenant because it's the easiest one. I said it's the easiest one because we can actually see it. So that's the background here. So we're going to talk about the Abrahamic covenant and how has this worked out in history. And we know that this covenant is unilateral from God to Abraham, no feedback, no participation. It's unconditional. You can't give it away. You can't do anything with it except enjoy it. And this covenant lasts forever. And like I said, there's no conditions in heaven or earth can change its meaning. So we have the land contract is an easily seen aspect of the covenant, and it's even easier for us today because we have been witness, in my lifetime at least, witnessed the coming of Israel as a nation, which is now 2,500 years since they had a nation. So we don't want to miss the learning opportunity here, realizing that God is true to his word in its very detail. So we have this land opportunity to see God work, make his word good. Now, we don't want to fall into the trap. I read this on the internet yesterday, and a guy responded to something. He says, we don't want to fall into the trap of those who say that the historical events of the Bible, or even in our day, do not matter. That's Hellenistic. It doesn't. This material world does not matter. That's not right. It does matter. It does not matter whether there was a literal Sodom and Gomorrah, which is the point he was talking about, whether it was destroyed or not, or whether it was a mystical story, he says. What difference does it make? And I say all this shows a lack of faith in God's record and his ability to determine the historical facts. So it does make a difference. You know, some would say, well, I don't want to, you know, base my faith on something that might not have happened because it's just a story. Well, I said, no, it's not. If it's in the Bible, it's not just a story. And it's there for us to learn. So why do we need to know this stuff? Whatever the historical fact is, whether it's the Bible or whatever, remember the truth. With the truth, you never know where it's going to lead us. And I think that's the reason we do this. So we have before us the next few weeks a series of historical lessons that have been superintended by God. Underline that. It's been superintended by God. Just as he did the Exodus crossing of the Red Sea or the destruction of 20,000 Syrians on the hill of Judea at the time of Sennacherib. We have the same God looking out for the people who have paid a dear price for their unbelief over nearly 24 centuries, but God did not cast them away. He will keep his promise and return them to the land that I will give you. And so we are watching with anticipation that act of God that was prophesied nearly 2,000, 4,000 years ago. So again, if you're interested in the Exodus story, I got a bunch of typos today. There was another one. And if you're interested in the Syrian story, or if the story of Jael, who drove the tent stake into Sisera's temple, if you like that kind of stuff, or don't like that kind of stuff, you want to hear about the work of God in establishing Israel in the land, because it's on that level, it's on that class. So to this history, we want to give our attention. All right. So let me do this. Go to my board over here. Hope that works. The reason I want to do this lesson, which is an addition to what I've taught before, is that usually the lesson is British. And the British did it all. And with the help of the United States, Israel becomes a nation. It's not untrue, but it's not telling the whole story. So just to give you an idea of what happened in the timeline, I'm going to just walk it through with you. Before the Zionist conference, Zionist is just a word for being supportive of a national home for the Jews. So Christians can be Zionists. Jews can be anti-Zionist, and there were many. Did not see that they wanted to have their cart upset or their life disturbed by the possibility of them going back to land because they thought it would be futile and useless, and we've never had it for 2,000 years. Why should we now listen to somebody that wants to do it? It's a waste of time, and it's going to make our life miserable. In fact, my life in America or in England or Russia or Poland or anywhere in the Eastern European countries, it's okay. Don't want to mess with it. So there were Jewish anti-Zionists. Probably in the beginning, more of those than there were that were pro-Zionist. And there were also pro-Zionist Christians. And there were probably in this group, there would have been quite a few true believers in the Christian God like we believe. Because they read their Bible and it says this. And so, well, the Jews should have their own land. It looks like that's what the Bible says. So if you thought that way, then you would be a Christian Zionist. So I would say, am I a Christian Zionist? I suppose in categories I am, although I don't actively support because I don't think it's a political activity that we need to be involved in. But in terms of the idea, yeah, because the Bible I think the Bible says it's their land. So I'm a Christian Zionist. So I'm at that point, what a Zionist is. Where the Zionist is. So when the first Zionist conference was called, it would be because there were some things happening in the life of the Jews here that was so bad that Theodor Herzl, a journalist from Austria, saw the miscarriage of justice in what's called the Dreyfus Affair, where a Jewish guy in the military was accused of something he didn't do, accused of treason. And that was that was at the end of a string of other things that had happened. That was about early 90s. This Dreyfus guy was accused. Before that, 1881, we had the pogroms, the attacks on the Jews in Russia. And then we have another Damascus affair where the Jews were accused of killing Christian kids. You know, so Theodor Herzl says, you know, we're not getting any better here. This is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And I think I got to do something about this. And so on his own, by himself virtually, he establishes a conference in Basel, Switzerland, and had about 400 people come to attend it. So that's where the Zionist movement officially began. And this Theodor Herzl, interestingly enough, thought that in 50 years, the Jewish people would have their own state. And it ended up being 51. So, I mean, was that prophetic? I don't know. I mean, did God give him that sense? I don't know, but he was right. All right? And by the way, when we're talking about these people, except some of these that are in England, they're probably not believers as we are believers. But God doesn't just work with believers. He works with all nations. And so he'll do work with these Jews. I don't know that any of these guys that I could tell at all were anything near to receiving the Messiah as Savior. They were Jews. And they understand who they were. They just rejected the Messiah. So we have Theodore Herzl starts this. So the Zionist Conference starts, and he basically works himself to death. Because at age 44, he dies of a heart attack. His Link's dead. 44. And he just worked himself to death. And he was working against these anti-Zionist Jews. It was just like, oh, that's a great idea. Let me get on board, you know. And so it was very, very, very few people. And the way you would join this group, you would send one shekel into the organization, and that made you a member. And by that way, you could count how many were supportive of it. And it was just a relatively small number of people that were actually supporting the Zionist movement at the beginning, even though there were 400 delegates at this original conference. But as a Jewry is concerned, it was not supported. Okay, so this goes on, and he dies here about 2003. I used to never could say 2000. Now I can't say 19 anymore. So it'd be 1903 or 4 is when he dies. And so we have a space of time in here where the organization flounders a little bit because of lack of leadership. And then this man, Chaim, that's how you say this, Chaim Weizmann, German name, Weizmann, takes over. And Weizmann is an English person living in London. He is a he's a scientist. He contributes greatly to the World War I effort by developing acetone, which is used in explosives. And this benefited the Allied, we call it Allied armies our side, Allies army a great amount, so that curried favors with the British. So he had an in, interesting how God works, right? Give this man this talent to do this so that he's had an in with the British. You want to miss these opportunities, see what God does along the way. And there are so many of these things, and there's probably millions we don't see. Like even when somebody was born, what parentage he had, how'd they get to London. You know, all these kind of things are all part of God's superintending of the effort. So Weizmann now becomes the chairman of this Zionist movement. And I'm going to get how much detail I should get into here, but basically here, the idea needs to have legs, and it can't come just from the Jewish people. At the Zionist Conference, it was understood that if there's ever going to be, and I'm going to use the word a Jewish state, it's going to have international recognition. You just can't walk into a country and say, I'm a state. Like if I would do that to you, I'll walk in and say, I'm a state. And what would you do with me? He says, what? I have nothing. I have nothing. All I just said, I'm a state. Well, Jews can't walk in and say, I'm a state. So you have to have things in place that would make other people recognize you as a state. If I was the king, I'd say, well, maybe I'll show you my pedigree or whatever. But, you know, you can't do that. You have to have the credentials, the recognition of other nations in order for you to be a state. You just can't say you are one. Or else they'd have said that later. I said that a long time ago. It was said that in Russia, in the Russian area, and it's not Poland, they say, well, we are a state. The Jews said that in Russia. What would the Russia have done with those guys? You're treasonous. Lop off their heads or whatever. So you just can't just say, I'm a state. So there need to be sponsor? Something, someone else to carry some of the water to statehood. And they can't do it themselves, so it has to be another nation or another people that had status. Okay. So the first time this happens, and I just read this last night, and I'm reading and I'm always learning more things, but the first time thing with the British was here just at the beginning of World War I. I won't get into the detail of that because that's not even in my paper. But that's where it started, when Chaim Weizmann here became friendly with the English government because of his contribution, started to talk about the idea of a homeland for the Jews. Now remember, we're talking the possibility of being Christians, like George Lloyd George and Wallflor. This high percentage of chance they really were born-again believers. At least they had a high view of Scripture and understood the promises in the Bible for the Jewish people. And so they were pro-Zionists, although, you know, that was before there was a state. But they were pro-Jewish, with the idea the Jews should have their own land. Remember, think of all the history they've gone through, and those guys are not dumb. All the persecution and the countries they've been run out of, all the world, they've been evacuating people everywhere, you know, and now all of a sudden, by the way, we're right at the beginning of World War I, and it seemed like in the minds of the people, World War I, before it even happened, people somehow understood this is going to change everything. Because we have two factors in World War I that were adverse to world peace. One was Germany, and the other one was Turkey. And the Turkish Empire, called Ottoman Empire, shrank and more and more debt. So we get to the beginning of World War I, there's almost nothing left. Well, if you are a carnivorous, what's the word? You like to eat flesh? What's the word, carnivore? Carnivorous bird. You're flying over Europe, and you're the West. You're England, you're France, you're Italy, you're Russia, and you're sort of, you know, mouth starting to water. What can I get out of this? And so they start thinking, what can I get out of this? So I say, before it even happens, I think they knew that when this war is over, things are going to be different. Now they're thinking, the Zionists are thinking, maybe through this upset in the world, the Jews are going to get a chance, a window of opportunity to establish a nation. I think that was in the heart of the British people. So now, in a sense, we have a sponsor. We have a sponsor that can carry the water for the Jewish people who can't carry it for themselves. Well, what happens then in time, we get to the end of, where are we here? World War I starts here, end of 14, I think. Then we get to about 3 years into the war. We have a lot of stuff goes on here. But there's a letter issued by Lord Balfour to Rothschild, the Jewish titular head of the Jewish people. I mean, there was no organization as such. But since the Jewish people didn't have an address, they sent to somebody that looked like had one. That was Rothschild. He made a joke about that. I don't know where to send, so I just sent her to him. Well, Rothschild was a banker and a prestigious person in the Jewish life. So he sends this letter to Rothschild declaring His Majesty's intention that they establish a homeland for the Jews, and the word state's not used. Okay, so it took a while to get to that, and a lot of stuff I'm going to tell you is before the information before that letter is issued. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you next week. Before that letter was issued, which was issued publicly, all the major nations of the Allied forces, now remember, we're now in the war, the four major nations, we have Italy, France, England, tell me one more, did I say Britain? Five. Russia, and United States. Well, the United States is out of this in a sense because they weren't in the war until the last year, but they were aware because they were neutral at that time. So we have these five nations. Oh, and the Catholic Church, all five of them signed off in writing in support of the Jewish state before the Balfour letter was ever issued. Now, that's the remarkable thing. You think, well, it was just the British did it. The British United States and President Wilson, those two guys did it. No, those guys would never have done it unless they had support from all the Allies. So that's the story, because once you got them, the story is once they got them to do it privately, you know, then they were forced to do it publicly. And when it was become public, you can't embarrass yourself by backing out of an agreement. Now, we've had this a little bit with Trump and the Iran agreement. Remember, now we have that, how can you back out of that? Well, it wasn't an argument. It wasn't a governmental agreement. It was a presidential, what do you call it, order? You know, so it doesn't carry the weight of the government, so he can back out of it. Well, if the government does it, though, if the government does it, and it's done by Congress, for example, then if you back out of it, your name is mud because you can't be relied on. So when the president does an executive order, it's as good as his executive order. And when he's out of office, pfft, who cares? I mean, that's all it is. So I'm just saying that these endorsements privately are good. But what we really need then before the Balfour letter is issued, there was also all of these nations were, not say forced, but in the end they were outed in the open supporting Israel as a nation. Now, if you're thinking a little bit here, like you should be thinking, wow, Israel's got it made. All the nations on the western side that are against Germany and Turkey all agreed. All agreed, understand this, in writing, in public, no secret agreements, that they should have their own state. Even to this, that they all thought state. No one thought, a people within a people. All right, so that's what we have. And then the Balfour letter is given. And that supports that the Balfour, at the last end, the United States wasn't one of those I listed before, but Balfour goes to the United States, talks to Woodrow Wilson, gets his commitment, but Woodrow Wilson says, I support you, but I can't do it publicly. See, we can't got this secret stuff. You can't do it publicly. But in the story, as it goes, if Wilson would support it privately, secretly, that's all Balfour needed to go home and start the wheels moving. And as soon as he got home and starts the wheel going, then America jumped on board and became public in their support. So, and the end result was they were all publicly supporting of Israel as a nation. Okay, we have Italy, we have Britain, we have France. I missed France before, I think. And we have Germany, Russia. And they add to it, if you want to call it a state, is the Catholic Church. Yeah, it is. And it goes in the face of everything the Catholic Church stands for. And that's what the text says, that in spite of what the Catholic Church's stance has been against Israel all these years, the Pope even said, this is providential. This is providential. Isn't that interesting? When a guy gets to a corner and God says, you're going to say this, they say it. You know? Who was it that Jesus was predicted to be killed by the high priest? It says... Yeah. Now we go to question, because that's about the end of the story. I want to go today.
What's he do? What
is sheer effort. Sheer effort. Remember, he died at 44 out of exhaustion. So this means, you know, like a jet-setting, you know, traveler and making contacts and call him a lobbyist.
He had no particular influence?
No. Well, he's a journalist. Journalist. Yeah, right. And he went to cover the Dreyfus affair, and he saw the miscarriage of justice on the soldier who was a treason, who wasn't not guilty, obviously not guilty, but they declared him guilty, and that stirred his heart. And it says we need some, you know, obviously the Lord used him.
Another question I have: who referred to him as?
I think that's right. So here we go. Let's don't get Hellenistic here. God's interest is in the world He created. And He says, this land, my land, I'm going to give to Abraham. Now, this is after we've had the flood, after the Tower of Babel. Man's had two tries to get it right. He can't get it right. So God finally says, I've got to take hold. I've got to control the reins, all of them. And I'm going to do this through a man, Abraham, and I'm going to force it on him. And I'm going to produce righteousness on this earth through this man, through Christ. But it's got to be on this earth. It isn't in this, on Mars, or that's not even good because that's a place. So, yeah, I think we want to tie what God does in eternity to the earth, what He created. I mean, I like strawberries. Why did God make it that we like things on the earth here? I mean, I can't imagine. I love space food. Well, how can you have it without the land? I'm not arguing against you. That right, can't without. Right. What they plant, they would eat, and what they build, they would live in. Yeah, those kind of promises. We're not talking about heaven either. We're talking about earth.
Yeah, that's my simple way of thinking.
Yeah, well, I just think in no other way that I know of is it more clear that what God has done is in this world than the land, the promises He made to Abraham on this land. Just that's just tangible. Like I said, this is one place we don't have to have faith. It's something we can see. Because I've walked on it, some of you have walked on it, you've seen the place, it's land, it's their land. And now we've seen all of it. Okay, lost control of the nation in 586, the Babylonian captivity. Okay, now they were in the land, obviously, till, let's say, 135.
And they were taken out.
Kicked out to the extent that they would. That's when the Shekinah glory left, yeah, the temple.
Wow.
Yeah, from then on, they were under Persian rule, Greek rule, Roman rule. So really, that's, you think about that now, in 1948, for the first time, they were an independent nation since 586 B.C. That's 2,500 years ago.
Amazing.
It's amazing. I sometimes say, well, yeah. No, that is huge. It doesn't have to stutter. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. There's so many times in there you get tired of looking them up. You go through all the Psalms and all the prophets, you know, it just again and again. And that's part of what wears people out. There's so many, you know, you say, well, I guess. I'm over here. There's a class over here, too. Yes. Well, he's British. He's a British Secretary of State under Lloyd George. I can't ever say that word, Lloyd George. There was a meeting. I can't answer that. I know that was in the book I read last night, exactly what it was, but just like not a chance meeting, but an arranged meeting for these men to talk about, and that's where it started to take root. Now we're getting into the word called God's glory. Isn't we talk about God's glory is God's credit. This could not have happened by humans. I mean, no one could have orchestrated this. That's what I would call, it's a one aspect of God's glory, is when you give him credit for what's been done. Give him the credit. Remember in Revelation, we just had that on Sunday morning, the rocks fell on them and they did not give God the glory. They didn't give God the credit for doing this. Something else was doing it. They didn't say, if they said, well, this is God doing it, then we better go do something about our relationship with God. No, they denied that it was God doing it and they didn't give him the glory. Right, and what the world do does not give him glory. So the principle is to credit. Giving God credit for what he does is his glory. And I think there's another aspect of it, but I think that's the way I like to think of it, is the easiest way of looking at it, and it usually fits. Yes, I did not, I remember when I was talking, I remember I had not talked about Sokolow, because he's kind of the guy that is behind the current here, or underneath the surface. When I talk about it, you go to get private commitment from all these nations, and then come back and get public commitment from all these nations, that's Sokolow. That's his contribution. He was the jet setter. They weren't jets, but he was the worldwide traveler, going from place to place to place to place, and providing, they call it the lobbying work activity, with these nations. And these guys are well placed, to and they, you know, people in the world are, and so they have contacts with these people and make these arrangements. So he went to all these guys, you know, whether France or not Britain, not necessarily, although Britain was not an issue here. But Russia, by the way, drops out because, remember, the Russian Revolution was in, anybody remember the year? It started in 17, had two revolutions, 17. So by the time you get to the end of 17, where we have the Balfour Declaration, they're out of the war. They're in shambles. They now are being under the communist rule with Lenin. So in a sense, Russia has nothing to say anymore. So leave them out. So he goes to, and the Pope, and he goes to the Pope twice when people said, no, you can't do that, but he did, and he got his approval. So Sokolow is the guy that actually did the work. In fact, if you're going to put up Weissman or Sokolow, who's the most important person here, you'd have to put Sokolow up. Then I'd say, well, why isn't he up there? Well, here we have a little bit of typical Jewish or human hubris when Weissman was the president. And he wrote about it, and he was the big shot. And so the guy at Sokolow, who did all these things, but he wasn't important, gets pushed to the side. He didn't write about it. He didn't write his memoirs, no biography. Biography of him has ever been written. So he just sort of disappears. He's a Russian Jew.
What was his lot in life that he had this power? He was
another thing that he did was one of the many things that he did. He was a journalist. He ran a paper, published, and again, one of these things you don't think about, but he was the guy that promoted the Hebrew language, again, the dead language amongst the Jewish people when it started being the language. And so he is credited with his publication to reintroduce Hebrew into Israel.
Power of the media.
Right. But so these things are now coming out, not now coming out. They're now this guy that I'm sourcing writes about. And all of a sudden, wow, this guy really is probably more significant than and Weizmann. I just got to show you. I just think he's an interesting guy. I mean, he is described as a very distinguished person, and I thought, look at that face. I mean, he would just melt your heart, wouldn't he? Just come on, you know. So, I mean, God gives people faces, and he gives them personalities, and gives them, you know, a desire. All these kind of things we don't need to think about, but there are so many little details that have to go together for every day to be accomplished what God wants that our mind just goes crazy trying to think about it. But he is the guy. Sokolow is the guy that was at today after night, 80 years after his death, only a few historians remember Sokolow, and none has trouble to produce a scholarly biography. So anyway, that's the guy. I thought I wanted to show you his picture because it helps to see him. And I thought, you know, and they have a description of his, how he dressed and how he comported himself. And remember, he's walking around as a statesperson without a state. I mean, he could walk in embassies and talk to people as if he was a state. He's not a state, you know. Right. So see, all of a sudden you go back and I'll tell one more story. This is going to be in here. I've got to tell you it again. But one of the reasons people think, why did the Jews get the attention in World War I? Why? As the story goes, they think that because of the Jewish influence in world affairs, that if you would curry the favor of the Jews, it would affect the outcome of World War I. And it would be to the betterment of the Jews if the Allies won. Okay, now we're sitting here thinking, Jews, what kind of authority, what kind of support have they got? Or what kind of influence have they got in the world? Go back to 1904 when the Protocols of the Elders of Zion book was published, which was an attack on Jewishness and an accusation that the Jews rule the world. So they believe this false document, the false dossier, they believe the false document, but the Lord used that false credibility to make the world think that they really had this power. I mean, it's one of those kind of things. God meant it, you know, Joseph meant it for, Jacob's sons meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So even our author says this is one of those, what he called the improbabilia of politics, that something that would be so against the Jews would be used so much in support of them. And here we have this God doing the thing again that just blows you away. Yes, yes, but not the extent that they thought he did, and that's where the irony is. Rothschild is a very important person. I don't have him up here because one of the things you have when you have a nation, this is some of the argument, do you establish yourself as the nation first against all odds, or do you get the people into the land and then establish the nation? And can you imagine there'd be two sides to that argument? Well, both is true, and both were true. And Rothschild facilitated a lot of the return way before here to the land. Rothschild supported that. So, okay. Now I feel a little better. Now, if you just don't forget anything I said, and if I hope I said everything right, we'll do that. Yeah. Now, if you want to get a jump on the story, if you go on Mosaic, a Jewish website, and look up, I'm going to hold it up for you. It says Mosaic, and it says the forgotten truth about the Balfour Declaration, the forgotten truth. And the last name of the author is Kramer. And it's only 21 pages long. And you only want to read it two or three times. But this is basically the source on the Sokolow contribution to it and the behind the scenes that was going on before Balfour ever got it. And there's other issues that we've got to talk about. You know, this issue of self-determination of the land, how was that applied? Who came up with the idea? What does it mean? What about public diplomacy? Because public diplomacy really was the child of Sokolow. He knew very well that you couldn't have an agreement of nations by back door, under the counter agreements with somebody, then come on and claim it. You have to have everybody agree to it, then you do it, because all you got to do is that one guy pulled the plug and you're done. So they understood all that, and so they worked really hard to make this a public thing, public before the whole world. And of course, we know the British turned on them because they got different administrations now, no longer supported the Jews in it, and that's the rest of the story, so to speak. Probably Wiseman more than Rothschild. You know, it's sort of like Roth. I don't know how much money Rothschild had. Well, I'll tell you how much money he had. When Weizmann goes to the Turks, and by the way, this is my theory on why World War I happened at all, the stupid war. When Weizmann went to the Turkish and said, this is before they fell, says, can our Jews live in your land? We'll support you as a nation, not a people in the land of Turkey. And the Sultan said no. And the problem that Turkey had at this time, they were so deeply in debt that Weizmann, on a limb, said, well, Rothschilds will bail you out of your debt.
So he had a few bucks.
Now, Rothschild never said he'd do that, but he used it as a bluff, and the Turks turned him down. And then I said, okay, the Lord said it this way. If you're not going to give the land to the Jews peacefully, the Lord's going to take it from you forcibly. And that's exactly what happened. Another little story. So a lot of times we talk about World War I liberated the land of the Jews. World War II made the Jews ready for their land. Because there are a lot of anti-Zionist Jews that weren't ready to go. In fact, half of them still haven't returned to the land. Even though half of them live in the United States, the other half, so to speak, live in Israel.